Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Ahoy, and welcome to The Wonder, science-based paganism, and as well, welcome to Talk Like a Pirate Day. We're recording on September 19th, which is a holiday I celebrate every year. So today we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to talk about playfulness as a part of pagan ritual practice. And specifically, we're going to get into talking about the senses and invoking all of the different senses in the process of organizing rituals so that we really submerge into a multi-sensory experience when we craft them or when we enact them. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're going to talk about today. But before we do that, we really need to say a word about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was a hero. She made tremendous changes for the status of women and girls in our country in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it just cannot be said enough what a difference she made in so many dimensions to the advancement of justice and equality in our country. So it is a real loss that she died last night, and we're mourning.
Yeah. And hoping that there will be and are many more like her.
Yes.
In this world, yeah.
Yes. When you read her biography, it is an extraordinary tale of a woman who was simply too smart and too determined to be held down by endless layers of repeated sexist intervention that blocked her from what she wanted to do. Everything from her not, she had made the law review and graduated with honors held honors and then graduated from two Ivy League schools, and she couldn't get a Supreme Court clerkship because they assumed that she was just going to go home and make babies. Mm-hmm. It was just such a different time, and she fought tooth and nail for equality. So thank you, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Hail the goer.
Yeah.
So that said, and I know that many of our listeners are really reeling with this right now, and I'm sure we could take up an hour talking about it, but that's not what we're here for. Let's talk about our subject for today, which is about engaging the senses and playfulness in our ritual practice. Yucca, what do you have to say about that?
Well, that I think it's great. on a lot of levels. One, I think from a very practical level, it makes ritual much more effective, but it also really feels good.
Yes.
You know, we are playful animals. Mm-hmm. Mammals are playful to begin with, but even for mammals, we are very, very playful, even into our adulthood. And I think that's actually something that we are missing a lot. And when we can invite that back in, it just has such a huge difference in quality of life. And we would talk about quality of life a lot on this podcast, but it's a really big deal.
Yes. Yes. It seems as though, at least in the mainstream overculture, we feel as though we have to apologize for being playful. And play is fun. It's pleasurable. It's a way of engaging life in a joyful way. And it's not frivolous. It's very, very serious. I mean, we look at children and we think, oh, they're just playing. No, they're learning all kinds of skills. They're discovering things about the world and about their bodies and how things work. Play is essential to the development of what we are. And then suddenly we decide around the age of 18, 20, well, we're done with all that. Let's get real serious and start making money. And yeah, that's not really a well-lived life. Play is essential to what we are, and we really need to be engaging that part of ourselves throughout our lives to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and to continue on what you're saying, you said some key words in there, I think, which are learning and play, and how those are so connected. When children are playing, they are learning. When you see puppies play fighting, they are learning. The learning part of our brain is actually being turned on at that point. And one of the things that we do in ritual is learning. We are that's what we're doing. We're changing ourselves. And the play activates that. It activates all of those learning pathways.
Absolutely. It really does. And I have been involved in a bunch of different ritual celebrations that have directly engaged games and other play-like activity, whether it's tying knots in yarn or dancing around a maypole, or there was one May Day where I competed in the May games to see who would be the May King and May Queen, and one of the games was Nude Twister. They put dots of colored frosting on various parts of our bodies, and we played Twister using those colors, spinning the spinner, and then you had to put your hand on a spot of yellow or whatever. It was messy and weird, but really fun. We were all laughing so much we could barely stay in position. Mm-hmm. I think playful activity is something that we tend to relegate to children, but which can be defined in adult contexts. Mm-hmm. Much of what we do that really fills us with joy comes out in the form of various kinds of play activity. And so today we want to talk about how we can best do that in our rituals, and specifically how we can engage all of the senses to make that more powerful for us.
Yeah. So let's see, do we want to pick a sense and start with that, or stay a little bit on the play or fun before we jump into a particular sense?
I think I'd like to talk a little bit about ritual as play.
Okay.
I think ritual is in its essence, it's playful behavior. It's not work. It's not there to generate you food or to ensure that you're sheltered or safe or warm enough or any of those things. It's there to speak to your metaphorical mind about what's important, but it's also there simply for the pleasure of doing it. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to the topic of the so-called witchy aesthetic, which I think we all know what it means, even though it's very hard to describe it. But it's bats and bones and skulls and
herbs hanging,
and pentacles and just all those kinds, and candlelight, definitely candlelight or firelight, one or the other. All of those things can be very attractive to people that are first exploring what kind of a ritual practice they'd like to have on their own. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of criticism of this, the idea that the witchy aesthetic is just, I've heard it called LARPing, live action role playing. As opposed to so-called real paganism.
I don't know. LARPing's pretty great, frankly.
Yeah, LARPing is really pretty great, frankly. I got in severe trouble once when being accused of LARPing by having non-theist pagan practices. Mm-hmm. Because my response was, you're LARPing too, you just don't know it.
Or aren't admitting it.
Well,
yeah.
If you believe in these gods that I don't think exist, mm-hmm. then, you know, you're going through all these motions for these gods and there's nobody there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think LARPing's pretty great. I think acting as if mm-hmm. we have magical powers, as if we are sorcerers and witches. And I mean, that's all very powerful archetypal stuff. Mm-hmm. And we can create through our senses an experience for ourselves that will carry over into the reprogramming of our minds to make changes in our lives. That's kind of core to my whole belief system, that we can do that. I believe we have the power to make those changes in ourselves. Do you have more to say about that, Yaka?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot wrapped up in there, but I think coming back to the witchy aesthetic or any other thing kind of like that, just want to say briefly that I've also seen a lot of criticism of this kind of thing, or somebody choosing a particular thing to criticize some other pagan about, that they're not pagan enough because they don't believe in these gods, or because they like the witchy aesthetic, or because the first book they read was some particular author who's fallen out of fashion or something like that. And you know, I'd encourage folks to just kind of let that go. It's, you know, however somebody comes into it, whatever they're interested in, then is it hurting you? I mean, I guess it can, if it's hurting your perception of being part of the superior group, I can see why that would be threatening. But ultimately, I don't think that's very useful. If the goal is an improved quality of life and sense of connection with the natural world and community, then it's okay if somebody's into an aesthetic you're not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the thing to bear in mind, to my mind, is everybody has a unique path. Mm-hmm. Everybody is different. And what that means is that if something really sings to you, then it's almost certainly the thing that's good for you. If something really appeals to you in this like super visceral kind of way, like, ooh, wow, that's really cool, I really want to be doing that, well, you probably really should be doing that.
Yeah.
And there's no reason for you not to, so long as it's not self-destructive.
Yeah. And even or if it feels cheesy, because a lot of what we're going to talk about, especially with the play, might feel kind of cheesy, but that's that judgment coming in on it. It's okay. Cheesy's fine, right?
I mean, at our High Spring celebrations for a few years running, we played children's games, and I can't tell you how cheesy it feels to be in your 50s and playing Chutes and Ladders, but it was fun. It was really fun to do.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, playing Chutes and Ladders with a 4-year-old. I mean, that's part of what's great about it, is that for them, it's this completely engaging, engrossing, you know, challenging sort of mental task. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for us, we're drinking May wine and playing around. And anyway, but it was great. It was a wonderful time for everyone.
Yeah.
So playfulness. Playfulness is about permission. Mm-hmm. Because we learn as we get older to not be childish. We're told not to be childish. And there's a validity to that. I mean, there are ways that children are emotionally unregulated and not able to think about longer term consequences and those sorts of things that we definitely want to put away as we get older. Mm-hmm. But what becoming older and adult must not mean is to become sour and gray and miserable.
Yeah.
And so many of the things that we are really encouraged to take on, you know, I'm reminded of the terrible, terrible phrase, life is hard and then you die. And people say that, and no, that's horrible.
Why?
A horrible.
Why do that, right?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way at all. So let's talk about creating ritual as a playful process, mm-hmm. and kind of walk through the different sensory things that we can do that will really stimulate us in lots of different ways.
Yeah. Well, but before we jump too much further in, there is a specific activity that I want to share that people can try. And this is something that we've talked before about gaming, doing role-playing, Dungeons and Dragons, things like that. Something that I will do for myself is before I go to play, especially if I'm playing the game master and I've got to do a bunch of different character voices and all of that, I will literally go off by myself in the bathroom or even in front of someone and just make weird noises with my mouth. Just go, just start moving my mouth, you know, and get it all, get that tension out of the jaw and just get okay with making weird, silly sounds and maybe even shake my body a little bit. And that releases, just practicing that for a few minutes releases a lot of that judgment and tension being held there. And that's something that I invite people to try, is see if just doing that before you get into the ritual space or as part of the ritual structure of letting go, you know, see how, if that helps you at all.
It's a great idea. Yeah. Because what we're up against as we try to bring our playful selves to the fore is that critic voice, mm-hmm. that says, you look stupid, this is pointless, la, 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 la. And that voice just has to be put in a room and told, I love you, but goodbye. And
maybe stick your tongue out at it while you're at it.
Yes, I love you, but boy, you're completely full of it. And close the door, and then we go off and we can have our joyous, adventurous experience.
Yeah.
And I choose that word, adventurous, deliberately, because I think of rituals as adventures. Mm-hmm. They're sort of gravity wells that you fall down into, and then you discover what's all around you. Once you go into a sort of trance-like space of presence and hyper-awareness, you're never entirely sure what's going to happen next. And you can arrange surprises for yourself, like drawing tarot cards, for example, because you don't know what they're going to be. And so then, you know, meanings will leap out at you that you wouldn't necessarily have thought of otherwise. So really, when we talk about ritual, I strongly think about ritual as a play activity. Mm-hmm. It's play for adults. Although children can do it too. Children do rituals all the time. You know, children have a very strong sort of magical thinking quality. So they'll develop an association between one thing and another thing. And, you know, if I have to go around the pole on the playground three times in order for this good thing to happen, well, that's what I'm going to do. and there's nothing wrong with that. Although we do need to end up learning critical thinking and to kind of differentiate those things that are valid from those things that are just fun.
Yeah. Well, and to be aware of that so that we can choose which skill we're going to use at what point.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what sense would you like to talk about first?
Smell.
Okay, let's talk smell. Smell is super powerful. It goes all the way down to the lizard brain. Mm-hmm. The earliest organisms, the single-celled organisms, had the ability to sense the chemical composition of what was around them and to move away from danger and to move toward something that seemed like food. So this is a capacity that has been built into us for hundreds of millions, billions of years of evolution. Mm-hmm. And we still have it. And it is our sense of smell. So think about it. In your life, you know that there are certain smells that conjure entire scenarios in your mind. If, you know, if there's that particular smell of a particular recipe of cookies coming out of the oven, you know, suddenly it's mom and it's, you know, the old family house and whatever those associations are. But we have a library of dozens of those special smells. And what I really enjoy is being caught unaware by one. I'll be walking along and there'll be some kind of a plant that has a particular smell and like, oh, suddenly I'm in Colorado with my grandparents.
It just takes you back instantly. Yeah.
Yes. It's fantastic. So smell's really powerful. What do you do with smell in your ritual practice?
I use smell a lot. I use smell in the home on a regular basis, but I also will, when doing a more intentional ritual, do something like use a very strong smell to associate it with whatever the changes I'm trying to make, because the ritual is often about creating some sort of change. And so I'll choose something that is a strong smell and an unusual smell, or a strong smell that I'm going to come across often. For instance, we have a lot of, where I live, we've got a lot of junipers, and that's the two main trees. We have pinyon pines and junipers. And junipers have a really intense smell when you touch them or brush into them. So taking some of that and using it in the ritual then carries through later on, because I associate that smell with whatever I was doing. And then I bump into the tree when I'm walking out to the car to get, you know, to wherever I'm going. And it's that connection. Like you were talking about being drawn back right away, instantly to whatever it is, but now it's been an intentional connection that I've made. So that's one way of working with smell.
That's great. And that's a super good example, because what you're doing is you're creating your own anchor memories, the ritual process. But you're doing it by deliberately seeding a smell that you know is out there in your environment a lot. So you're going to keep getting these reminders. If you do a ritual that's about, I am capable and powerful and competent, and here's this smell about me being capable and competent and powerful, and then you go out into the world and that smell keeps showing up, you're getting this constant psychological reminder that you're capable and competent and powerful.
Yep.
That's just very, very clever, basic magic, you will, in the sense of psychology, transformational programming. That's great. I don't use smell as much as I would like to, because my partner has a lot of sensitivities. But I have a large collection of incenses, mostly very old-fashioned incenses, like Russian Orthodox Church incense and frankincense and dragon's blood resin. I like the resinous incenses very much. And I use those because, particularly the dragon's blood incense, when I burn it, I'm instantly in magical space. Instantly in magical space. And I've used that around campfires. I've thrown a handful into campfires so that I could smell it there. I've deliberately anchored myself in ritual space around this smell so that I can get there faster. If I really need to get into a trancey sort of state, I can burn a little bit of that and maybe play some music that I also associate, and I'm there. I've also used cedar oil. for Hallows rituals, Samhain rituals. Every year now for 29 years, this will be our 30th year coming up, because for some reason, cedar reminds me of a coffin. It reminds me of, you know, what it might smell like if you were lying in a coffin and you were breathing.
So,
anointing it just a little bit on the forehead or on the lower lip creates that spooky, evocative association that we've had with these rituals over this long, long period of time. And it's very powerful, very powerful. What shall we talk about next?
Well, taste for me is very, very similar to smell. I'd use that in a very similar way. And I mean, even physically what's going on with how we taste and smell is tightly connected. So is there a way that you use taste differently than smell in your practice?
You know, there is, because during the gratitude phase of my rituals, eating and drinking is kind of a, sharing food and drink is a thing that I like to do. And I think it's a powerful way for people to feel connected with one another. And it also kind of helps them with grounding a little bit after the end of a ritual, to have some food or drink in them. And so there are particular flavors that I associate with ritual practice that I don't really associate otherwise. Pomegranates are a very strong example in the fall. Pomegranates are, you know, Persephone's fruit. And so they're very much associated with fall and death and that whole mythological cycle.
And so is that something that you have, that you almost exclusively eat in a ritual context, or is it something that you have outside of ritual as well?
Generally, I don't outside of ritual, but we always have pomegranates at our Hallows rituals. And there's just, everything about it has got that sort of flesh harvest quality to it. I mean, you eat it with your hands and it's messy and blood runs everywhere and it's just, it's got all that.
Yeah.
It's easy. The metaphors are not very stretched.
Yeah. You get there pretty quickly. Yeah.
Exactly. And they're sweet and delicious and tangy, and there's all that kind of quality to them too. And beautiful. Visually, they're very beautiful fruit. So when it comes to taste, it's more about the sort of specialized things that I only do for particular Sabbaths. I make a sparkling ginger orange spiced mead. It's like champagne. It's super, super bubbly. In fact, I make it in champagne bottles because otherwise they would explode. And it's just incredibly delicious. And I've associated that with the May Day Beltane season for a very long time. It's been a few years since I've made it, but I'm hoping to arrange for some cleared out refrigerator space so I can...
negotiation there.
Yes, exactly.
Yep. Okay.
How about you? Particular flavors that you associate with being in a ritual state or any particular time of year?
Yeah, well, there's certainly tastes with particular times of year because we really make a point of eating as seasonally as possible. But I will use some herbal teas in ritual, but usually not food. And so those teas... It, for me, it's really hard to separate between what is the taste and what is the smell. It's all really wrapped in there. So those two don't get really, they're just so, the lines are just so blurred between the two. It's almost like they're the same sense for me.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
Kind of like with me with the pomegranates, that whole tactile quality of the juice running and all that, that's and proprioceptic, that feeling of the hands coming to the mouth.
Yeah.
All that, that's the same kind of thing. And we should say, you know, these senses, they don't live in neat little boxes. They overlap with one another in many ways, and the parts of our brains that process them talk to each other. So you don't need to figure this out in neat categories. Just figure out what works for you.
Yeah, we're just using this as a framework to talk about different elements of the ritual. But yeah,
yes.
And we shouldn't forget to talk about propio, because that's, you know, the standard senses that we're all taught in elementary school are not all of the senses. We've got a lot more.
Yes. And particularly when you get into movement as a ritual art, dance and everything from kind of Tai Chi and Qigong kind of movements to full on, you know, wild dancing about a fire, all of that is deeply involved with understanding the body in space, mm-hmm. understanding where you are in relation to others, and certainly understanding where you are in relation to a fire.
Yes.
Real important.
Yes, very much so.
So shall we talk about sound?
Yeah, let's touch on sound.
Well, for me, when I think about ritual and I think about sound, the thing that I think about first is percussion.
Mm-hmm.
Rhythm and drumming and shaker instruments and cymbals and bells, all those percussive, rhythmic kinds of things that, I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm my body is starting to move because I'm thinking about them, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a tremendous power to that, and being able to at least be a competent drummer or keep a steady beat is a skill that I recommend to people if they intend to work with others in ritual contexts. It's something that's just very handy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of music that I use when I do solitary ritual as well, that is also very powerful for me. We can talk about some of those, as well as kind of soundscapes like rain and thunder or crickets or wind.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Well, I definitely use the soundscapes a lot. I use the soundscapes a lot in everyday life. I use music less because I am very, very sensitive to the music.
Mm.
It's overpowering to me. You know, I don't listen to music in when I'm just hanging out in the house, and because I just get so into it. And I don't always like being taken on the journey that the music is going on. But uh-huh. when I do get into a song, I'll listen to that song. I'll put it on repeat for about 20 times. Or, you know, I'll have my very, very specific music that I don't, I like, I'll be into a mood. I want to listen to my Scottish music, and it really bothers me when the Irish music gets mixed in with the Scottish, because they're completely different, thank you. And when I'm listening to my Irish, I don't want the Scottish in there. So I can be a little bit picky with the sound because it's so, so powerful. It's another one where it's just, you know, we've gotten really good as humans at working with this art that moves us.
Yes.
So, yeah.
And it's one of the great human mysteries. Why music? Why do we do it? Why does every culture do it?
Yeah.
It's obviously intrinsic to what we are, to be musical beings. And to me, that goes back to our initial thesis, which is that we are inherently playful beings.
Mm-hmm.
We do music because it gives us joy.
Yeah.
That's what it's for. It moves us in a variety of different ways, but it fundamentally, it gives us joy. And that's why we do it. And that's plenty of reason right there. Because
and all kinds of cultures and all kinds of religions, you'll see that's a very, very common theme is the music, especially the music when done together.
Yes.
The singing together or the drumming. And when you were talking about the percussion, I really associate that with group rituals.
Yes.
That's, and then some solo drumming for doing some inner meditations and journeyings like we talked about a few episodes back.
Yes. That very steady drum beat can be very trance-inducing. It's like, you know, the ticking of a watch. It just, that repeated resonant phrase over and over. And then if you're being guided by someone who has the chops for it, they can actually change the pacing of the rhythm depending on what's happening in the journey. Mm-hmm. Can be really, really powerful. And all of this is just stuff we do to play with our sensorium. It's effective, and we can learn how to do it well. We can learn how to do it better.
What was that word you just said? Sensorium?
Yes. Which is the gathering of all of our senses.
Okay.
Sensorium is all of our senses.
That's a great word. I'm going to write that one down.
Okay. So we haven't spoken about sight, about vision. And I would like to talk about sight and vision because we lead with this. Those of us that aren't sight impaired mm-hmm. kind of live in a visual world. We depend more on our vision than we do on any of our other senses to their deficit. Mm-hmm. If you don't have vision, you will have increased acuity in your other senses. But we are tremendously susceptible to visual cues that change our mood and our mental state, which is why movies exist. Mm-hmm. Of course, they have sound as well, but they didn't used to. When they were first invented, they didn't have sound, and it was people still flocked to see them because this visual experience was so powerful for them.
Yeah.
So that brings me back around to the witchy aesthetic, which, to be honest, I'm super fond of.
I am too. I use it quite a bit.
I think the reason that it's so attractive to people is because it works. Mm-hmm. I think that when you have a candlelit display with a knife and a skull and a bowl of salt and rose petals and all that stuff, the average person upon seeing that goes, ooh. Mm-hmm. And everything in their mind kind of downshifts into, wow, okay, we're in a really special place now. We're in a holy place, a sacred place. So we should take extra care with how we behave. The Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox churches are brilliant at this.
Yes.
This is not unique to pagans, and it's not freaking devil worship. It's this is ritual technology that is well established, and it really, really works.
Yeah. Well, and jumping off of what you said about the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox as well, although I have less experience with that, the architecture, the spatial awareness is another element that that we can really use in ritual is a choice about the space that we're in, whether we're in a small space or a room with low ceilings or high ceilings, or how does the color work? All of that, we are very, very tuned into that, even if we're not on that surface conscious level, mm-hmm. the background is as well. So, and that's tied into to visual, but it's more, it's our spatial awareness.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I told a story on the Atheopagan Facebook group, must be a month ago now. My room has always been kind of set up as sacred space. It's where I keep my focus, and you see this behind me, and I've got, you know, all these sort of amazing masks and stuff. But this room has never really felt quite right. Some of which is because I moved from a very beautiful place that got sold out from underneath us. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of a generic apartment. But you can make even a generic apartment into a very compelling and powerful place. I have this dark mirror. It's the darkest tint that you can get for glass.
Mm-hmm.
Painted black on the back, and then backed with cardboard that has sigils all over the cardboard, and then set in a round frame.
Okay.
Oaken. And I keep it covered from the light all the time. So it only lives in candlelight. And I've had this thing for many, many years, and I just never hung it up on the wall. There was a space for it, and I never did anything about it, and I was just sort of lackadaisical. Well, about a month ago, I got a nail, and I hung it on the wall. And suddenly my whole room went, wow, this is really cool place to be. This is exciting and magical, and I could make some really cool things happen here. So you never know exactly what the ingredients are.
Yeah.
Of what's going to take you to that place where your whole self goes, ooh. But it's out there. And it doesn't surprise me that pagans collect a lot of ritual stuff. I'm not into the commercial aspects of that, but you know, the antler that I found on a hike, and the deer skull that I found in my yard, and the pine cones and the seashells and the
raven's feathers and the
feathers and the abalone shell and all those, you know, kind of miraculous things, they all can create a montage that says magic to deep minds. And that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the little in me just jumps up and down with excitement when those elements get created. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh boy. Boy, we're going to do this. This is great. I love this.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's that play, like you're saying, there's the dress up and the make believe and that part that's just still living in us.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, I do want to say for folks listening though, that we're talking about very helpful tools, but you don't have to have these things to be able to do a ritual. No. These are tools that you could use, but they aren't, they're not mandatory. You're going to be just fine with whatever it is that you have.
And so, what you find really compelling may be different than what I find compelling.
And at different points of the year and different points in your life and all of that.
Exactly. Yeah. So I see that our time is wrapping up, and want to make sure that we respect that. So I will say, avast, ye lovers. We're going to row backwards now and round up our podcast for this week. We've seen a real jump in listenership, and I'm really grateful for that. Thank you to those that have just come on board. Remember, you can join us at the thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. So thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com with your questions, comments, input, suggested topics, all that kind of stuff. And we would love to hear from you. So please do.
And thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.